New information tonight about the death of Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old boy shot to death by Cleveland police.
We have created two societies that are deeply unequal. That is a fact.
The clash between white people and black people and other people of color is reaching heights not seen since the 1960s and 70s. We knew then what contributed to uprisings and riots.
White racism was the cause of the upsets and the uprisings that we had.
And people of color are still struggling a lot with these same issues, and in some cases, things are worse than they were back then.
As we see our struggle today, we see that some of those same issues are ahead of us.
I'm Lester Graham. This hour, the documentary Separate and Unequal from Michigan Radio and the Detroit Journalism Cooperative. During the summer of 1967, dozens of uprisings, protests, and riots erupted in urban centers across the nation. Detroit's was the worst. 43 people were killed. Most of them were black. More than 1,000 other people were injured. Parts of the city were burned to the ground. This is Separate and Unequal, a documentary from Michigan Radio and the Detroit Journalism Cooperative. I'm Lester Graham. A few days into the Detroit uprising, thousands of National Guard troops and thousands more police were already on the streets. The mayor and the governor wanted more help. President Lyndon Johnson sent in 5,000 U.S. soldiers.
I take this action with the greatest regret, and only because of the clear, the unmistakable, and the undisputed evidence that Governor Romney of Michigan and the local officials in Detroit have been unable to bring the situation under control.
Before the fires in Detroit were out, Johnson spoke to the nation again. He was appointing an 11-member special advisory commission on civil disorders. It was chaired by Illinois Governor Otto Kerner and became known as the Kerner Commission.
The commission will investigate the origins of the recent disorders in our cities. It will make recommendations to me, to the Congress, to the state governors, and to the mayors for measures to prevent or contain such disasters in the future.
The president wanted to know why. Why did these uprisings happen? Within 7 months, the Kerner Commission had an answer. Nathaniel R. Jones was assistant general counsel for the commission.
One of the conclusions of the Kerner report was that white racism was the cause of the upsets and the uprisings that we had. In fact, the report stated that white society created it, perpetuates it, and sustains it.
In other words, white racism, white attitudes were the underlying reasons for racial unrest in the cities. Many white politicians and news media vehemently resisted that finding. Detroit had been seen by the nation as a model of race relations. Many black people were getting jobs in Detroit that simply were not available to people of color in much of the rest of the country. Overlooked was the fact that Detroit African Americans often were given the hardest and dirtiest jobs, often were passed up for promotions, and generally made less money. Housing was inferior. Unemployment among people of color was higher. Relationships with police were strained. The commission also blamed the violent outbreaks on federal and state governments ignoring the plight of black residents. It blamed mainstream media for ignoring the problems and consistently presenting only the white point of view.
The commission said in its report that there was a combination of complex social, psychological, poverty problems all tangled up, which create this feeling on the part of people that they can't trust authority. And that was true as a lead into what happened in the 60s, and it's true now.
The report's most quoted conclusion read, "Our nation is moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal." The Kerner Report was published in paperback and it became a bestseller, but President Johnson barely acknowledged it. Joe T. Darden is a professor at Michigan State University and co-author of a book on the 1967 Detroit uprising. He says the Kerner Report challenged whites' attitudes about blacks, and he said that made President Johnson worry that it would damage the Democrats' chance to keep the White House.
The report put the responsibility for all of this stuff on white society and white institutions. That, I think, was a surprise to some white Americans, and I think that that was part of the reason he was very careful not to upset the large segment of white society. That was why I think that it happened like that.
Another factor in President Johnson's silence on the Kerner Report was his own ego. He felt the report ignored his accomplishments in the Great Society programs. But in a 1969 interview for the LBJ Library, Commission Chair Otto Kerner said praising Johnson's work would have given the report a political flavor the commission members did not want. Kerner said Johnson privately told him he was working quietly to implement Kerner Report recommendations.
He says, you know, we've been trying to do these things that you recommended in the report. And as you know, Congress is not very acceptable to the things that I proposed. Mm-hmm. But he said, I want you to know that I have the members of the cabinet, the White House staff people are still trying to have accepted those things I've already recommended.
But that's not what Johnson told one of his political buddies. A phone call between President Johnson and Chicago Mayor Richard J. Daley reveals Johnson had problems with the report. President Johnson's former Attorney General, Robert F. Kennedy, was running for president. He pushed the Kerner Report recommendations. But Johnson felt the commission's vice chair, New York Mayor John Lindsay, had pushed the commission too far.
And Bobby just gave me hell today for not carrying out the Kerner Commission study. Well, I didn't realize when I appointed Kerner that this son of a bitch from New York, Lindsay, would take charge. He did take charge, and he recommended I hire 2.5 million people on federal payroll, and I've not wanted to reflect on Kerner and criticize the commission. At the same time, I couldn't embrace it because I've got a budget.
That Johnson budget had doubled because of the escalation of the Vietnam War. Nearly five decades later, that report by the Kerner Commission is still considered one of the most insightful documents on race relations and remedies for discrimination to ever be published by the government. MSU professor Joe T. Darden says the cost of ignoring the Kerner Report has meant further decades of less opportunity for African Americans.
That would have eliminated this separation where you have central city, suburb. White, suburb, black, central city, white affluent, black poverty. That would have prevented that. They didn't take that alternative. What the Kerner Commission really wanted decided to do.
So what has that meant to America? Well, it's meant a quietly ever more divided country. Quiet until recently. For the last couple of years, the news has been full of stories about police killing unarmed African Americans.
That was Eric Garner saying over and over again, I can't
breathe.
Reported
at the scene where Freddie Gray was first taken into custody.
New information tonight about the death of Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old boy.
Some researchers believe police need a new kind of training. During the summer of 2014, a St. Louis suburb erupted in outrage. Protesters across the metro area wanted answers for the fatal shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. At the time, one woman, who only gave her name as Keela, explained to St. Louis Public Radio why so many people protested this latest shooting.
Because you've had so many within the last maybe 2 years, and I think this was the straw that broke the camel's back.
The protests went on for 17 days. Nearly 2 years later, Ferguson, Missouri residents are still concerned that police are too quick to shoot black people.
That decree should cover them as well.
Winfred Cockrell has been speaking out at City Hall meetings again and again because he thinks racial bias might have been behind the shooting of Michael Brown.
Stop looking at me, the color of my skin, judging me. Stop everybody. Just stop.
Cockrell was trying to persuade the Ferguson City Council to accept a Department of Justice agreement to better train officers to work within the community. That happened a few weeks later. In 1968, the Kerner Commission was concerned about both the police brutality that triggered some of the uprisings and riots across the nation and the response of police to the protests. The Kerner Commission report called for a demilitarization of police forces. Today, protests, peaceful protests, are met with military vehicles, SWAT teams, and police in riot gear. In Ferguson, Missouri, the largest police force, one of the 50 departments at the Ferguson protests, is the St. Louis County Police Department. The County Police Department leads the area's police academy. Police Chief John Belmar has been talking with the U.S. Department of Justice about how police could have better handled that situation.
I said, well, where will we focus the areas? So we thought training, we thought policy and procedures, bias-based policing, or bias-free policing, I'm sorry.
The idea of bias-free policing is something law enforcement just recently started embracing.
I think that there's implicit bias research and shooter bias research that makes it clear that there is a majority of people, disproportionately white, that view black people as a danger, as a threat, as a body that needs to be controlled.
Blanche Cook is an assistant professor of law at Wayne State University. That research found during computer simulations, some officers were initially more likely to mistakenly shoot unarmed black suspects than unarmed white suspects. But Cook says the researchers also found, with extensive training, officers were able to eliminate that bias.
If the flip side of the argument is that people cannot control their implicit bias, then that means they can't educate us. They can't police us. They can't ever have any kind of authority over us because they're going to act on that implicit bias at a subconscious level and never be able to control it. And we simply can't have that kind of world.
That kind of training is seen as especially important when the police force is majority white and the municipality's black population is growing. Back in Ferguson, Missouri, Winfred Cockrell says beyond police shootings, there's a larger matter.
It's time to finally put the big issue on the table. Race. We keep avoiding it like the plague. It's time to talk about it. It really is.
Coming to terms with America's racial issues can't be solved by retraining police alone, but the police might be the most important starting point. Blanche Cook from Wayne State University suggests police applicants should be tested for implicit bias. She also suggests special investigators and special prosecutors should be appointed when police kill people. The larger issue is this.
Until we deal with the way in which white supremacy, racism, and implicit bias frames the way in which we look at the world around us, we're going to continue replicating this problem again and again and again.
Much of white America defends the police and views the demonstrators as rioters who should let the justice system do its job. Others think the system is rigged against people of color and feel the only way they can be heard is through organizing protest groups and taking their grievances to the streets. That is what it took in the 1960s and 70s to be heard. A new generation of organizations is springing up. We'll hear from some of the people behind these new groups later in the program. But first, what are the injustices and inequities beneath all of this anger? Both in 1967 and today, it's education, housing, and jobs that pay enough to support a family.
I mean, these little jobs at the restaurants and little party stores, single mom is, you know, it's hard, very difficult for her to, you know, make a living off of that and raise her kids.
I'm Lester Graham. You're listening to Separate and Unequal from Michigan Radio and the Detroit Journalism Cooperative. You're listening to Separate and Unequal from Michigan Radio and the Detroit Journalism Cooperative. The Kerner Commission report reviewed the grievances they'd heard from black Americans across the nation. Police brutality and the justice system were two of the triggers that led to the civil disturbances. But it was everyday life underlying the discontent. African Americans didn't think their kids were getting a proper education. They felt they were not being treated fairly and getting jobs or equal pay. They knew they were paying more for housing, but that housing was inferior compared to where white people were living. All of those grievances still are issues in Detroit and other cities. It's gotten worse in the decades since the Kerner Commission report was released for many people. For example, the Detroit public school system struggles to properly educate kids. Even a recent bailout and restructuring effort won't make Detroit schools as good as the mostly white schools in the suburbs. The Detroit district went from a peak of 300,000 kids to 47,000. It went from 370 buildings to 91 buildings in an effort to save money. But ironically, closing schools in recent years has actually made the decline in school finances worse.
We're inside Hutchins Intermediate School.
Stepping over the broken concrete and leaf litter from people dumping in here.
Let's try and get to the debris. So Hutchins was built in 1922. It was actually one of a few prototype schools. It was very innovative for its time. In the early 1920s, the education system, as we know it, was really starting to come together, in particular public education.
John Grover works with Loveland Technologies. He and Yvette Vandervelde co-authored the report, A School District in Crisis. We're walking through the Hutchins building because the authors think it's a classic example of how nearly 200 buildings have been closed in the last 20 years and how the Detroit School District continues to spiral downward.
Hutchins was one of the first purpose-built intermediate schools. Before, a lot of junior high schools and high schools were just old converted elementary schools. Hutchins and its twin on the other side of the city, Barber, were designed for junior high school students.
And when was it shut down?
2012.
That recently?
Yes.
Wow. Back at the Loveland Technologies office in downtown Detroit, John Grover explained what they found as they studied the history of Detroit schools.
Studies found that about 30% of the students from a closing school would leave the district altogether and go to different schools. With each student having a price tag on their head of between $6,000 and $7,000 a year in student funding, the loss of those students is a tremendous financial hit. You're talking about losing hundreds of thousands of dollars. Then there were the follow-up costs. The anticipated cost saving from closing those schools was actually more or less wiped out in the first year by the one-time costs of moving everything out, moving the students to a new building, preparing the building to receive them, then securing the old building and maintaining the old building. As the years went on, the amount of money that they sunk into securing the buildings, especially after the scrappers started to come in, they would break in, damage the water pipes, the electrical wiring, start ripping that out. The cost of keeping up with the scrappers, keeping the building secure, dispatching the police every time that they had a burglar alarm going off was extremely high as well. After the building became essentially a rotted out husk, now they have to come up with the money to demolish them, which could range anywhere from $130,000 for a small school building to upwards of $500,000 to $1 million for a larger building. Those costs, all those costs after the closure, were not factored into the anticipated savings. And the loss of students, the permanent loss of 30% of students when you close a school, as well as all of those after the closing costs, has essentially made closing the school building not practical anymore.
The decline in the number of students since the Detroit Public Schools peak in the 1950s and 60s was dramatic. By the 1970s, only one in three kids was a white student, and they were concentrated in mostly white schools in the city. The U.S. Department of Education says kids at mostly black or Latino schools don't get as good of an education as kids at mostly white schools. Generally, teachers are not as experienced, and buildings are in worse shape. In the 1970s, there was a major court case that could have ended segregated schools in Detroit and the rest of the country. It would have made possible for children to get a good education no matter where they lived. The 1954 Supreme Court decision in Brown versus the Board of Education ruled that the idea of racially separate but equal was anything but equal. In the South, government began forcing school integration. In the North, it was a different story. By the 1970s, things were actually getting worse.
While the decisions in the southern states and the southern school districts were moving toward implementation, the segregation and isolation, racial isolation in the North, was increasing.
That's Nathaniel Jones, the same attorney who was on the legal staff of the Kerner Commission. A few years later, he was hired as the top lawyer of the NAACP. Detroit became a target for a desegregation lawsuit because a new state law actually encouraged more segregation. The case became known as Bradley versus Milliken. Ronald Bradley was a young student in Detroit and the first named in the suit. William Milliken was governor of Michigan. Joyce Baugh is the author of the Detroit school busing case. She says a judge found there were not enough white students in Detroit for any meaningful integration. He decided the only way to end segregation was by busing black Detroit students to the white suburban districts and suburban kids to Detroit. White suburban residents were outraged.
They were basically saying that they didn't think that their kids should have to go to schools with these black kids because there would be all kinds of problems and more racial problems, their kids wouldn't get a good education, they would be subject to violence, all of those kinds of things.
To give you an idea of how unpopular busing was, just the year before, a lawsuit to integrate Pontiac schools had argued for busing. Thousands of white parents and their kids took to the streets to protest. Before the school year ended, the Ku Klux Klan used dynamite to blow up 10 empty Pontiac school buses. The NAACP's lawyer, Nathaniel Jones, argued that school districts were basically units of state government since the state had authority over them. So state policies led to segregation throughout the Detroit region. The state of Michigan and the mostly white suburban districts fought it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. In arguments archived by the Illinois Institute of Technology, Michigan Attorney General at the time, Frank Kelly, argued the state was not responsible and the suburban districts did not cause segregation. The
trial court ordered a desegregation plan, including 53 school districts involving 780,000 students and requiring at least 310,000 of them to be bused daily and the school days, so that each school, each grade, and each classroom would reflect the racial makeup of the entire 53 school district area.
When the Supreme Court handed down its decision in the summer of 1974, it ruled Detroit schools with its 35% white student population would have to figure out how to desegregate itself without the help of the ring of white suburbs surrounding it. Justice Thurgood Marshall dissented. He saw the ruling in Milliken v. Bradley as a dismantling of the landmark ruling of Brown v. the Board of Education, which he had won just 20 years before.
Our nation, I fear, will be ill-served by this court's refusal to remedy separate and unequal education, for unless our children begin to learn together, there is little hope that our people will ever learn to live together and understand each other.
Today, the Detroit Public School District is 84% black. The district has been a financial mess with deteriorating schools for decades. A recent restructuring and bailout is not expected to make Detroit schools on par with surrounding mostly white districts. The bottom line is that too many black kids are not getting an adequate education to go on to college or to get a job in the skilled trades. A construction company owner who lives near the Chandler Park neighborhood says he hires young Detroit workers, but he finds some of them can barely read or solve math problems on the job. Zachary Rowe with Friends of Parkside in Chandler Park says he sometimes experienced the same problem with kids who went to both Detroit public schools and Detroit charter schools.
We have some youth workers that work with us during the summer, and they're between ages of 14 and 24. And I'm sort of surprised when it comes to some of the students having trouble doing basic math problems.
Chandler Park on Detroit's east side is part of the most impoverished census tract in Detroit. Recent data posted by Detroitography shows since 2000, this area has seen one of the largest increases in racially concentrated poverty. That's not the narrative you hear about Detroit. The story is most often about downtown's resurgence. Since downtown is booming, you might think these residents would be headed there for work. Kevin Boyle is an author and a history professor at Northwestern University. He grew up in Detroit, and he says there are few opportunities for Detroit residents in downtown.
Because what the downtown is doing is it's creating jobs that poor people aren't going to get. It's creating high-tech jobs in a city that, by at least one estimate that I've seen, says 47% of the adults in the city of Detroit are functionally illiterate. Now, that's not going to translate into high-tech jobs downtown.
And even if they could find jobs in downtown, it's not really practical. Public transportation, the bus, is often not a solution. Many employers won't hire people who depend on public transportation because it's not considered reliable. That means for many people, options for work are limited to nearby retail stores. I met Walter Brown at a Chandler Park Neighbors and Partners Association meeting. He says that's not enough.
I mean, these little jobs at the restaurants and little party stores, single mom is, you know, it's hard, very difficult for her to, you know, make a living off of that and raise her kids.
Kevin Boyle at Northwestern says it's good that Detroit's downtown areas are doing better, but until all of Detroit can share in the newfound prosperity, too many are being left behind.
And that's what you're seeing inside the city of Detroit today. You're seeing to a really dramatic extent an economic revival in the city of Detroit that is not completely white, but is white dominated and a dramatic level of poverty and inequality for large numbers of African Americans who live in the city.
Boyle says Detroit must find solutions for transportation, work skills training, and other obstacles to residents in the neighborhoods. Until they're able to get good-paying jobs, Boyle says there's very little to celebrate. Without access to jobs, many families' lives are precarious. Eviction and homelessness are often real threats. At one time, Detroit's black families had one of the highest home ownership rates in the nation. Now that rate is among the lowest. Every year in Detroit, thousands of people lose their homes to tax foreclosures. In many cases, it's unnecessary. The city is accused of illegal taxes and denying tax exemptions homeowners deserve. And homeowners are not the only ones affected.
Jackson, go sit.
When I got to Daryl and Alyssa Beaver's house, I was greeted by Jackson, their small dog. They've been living in a three-bedroom, two-bath, 1,600-square-foot home on Detroit's east side. There are a lot of nice houses in this neighborhood. The Beavers have been renting with the idea of eventually buying the home from their landlord, a friend of theirs. But Alyssa says a few months back, they didn't see or hear from the landlord for a while.
And so we went over to his house, and that's when he found out the landlord passed away. And then we found out it was like maybe 4 years worth of back taxes owed
on the house, and it wasn't being paid. So we got a foreclosure letter.
This is more than an inconvenience for the Beavers. It's more than just having to move. They've been working and spending their own money on this rental house.
We fixed the house up to move into it, to live in it. We painted everything. We fixed all everything in the house. The floors, we did everything. In the kitchen as well.
So you're invested in this house?
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We put the furnace in. We put the hot water tank in. We did everything ourselves.
Everything.
The house was auctioned off for taxes. The Beavers saved some money and worked with the United Community Housing Coalition to put in a bid for the home. They didn't get the house. It sold for $4,400. It's worth around $40,000. When we talked, they were supposed to meet with the new landlord soon to determine what the rent would cost or make arrangements to purchase the house, presumably at market price, or learn when they had to be out. They'd already received an eviction notice. The Housing Coalition will help them find a new place to live if it can. Ted Phillips is the executive director of the nonprofit advocacy group. The coalition helps thousands of people facing tax foreclosure in Detroit to stay in their homes.
Make sure if there are ways to get out of foreclosure, there are various kinds of payment plans and what have you. We try to make work with them so they're not throwing money away. And what I mean by that is if somebody owes $7,000, $8,000, $9,000 worth of taxes, they have no business paying $2,000 or $3,000 and losing the house anyway. So we try to do common sense type stuff.
Phillips says the city has worked to reassess properties that were overvalued and overtaxed, but that job is not finished. Some people are paying a rate five times what they should. In many cases, the homeowner should not be paying taxes at all. Their income falls below the federal poverty guideline, and they should be getting an exemption.
Very often, the common scenario we see is that somebody comes in for tax foreclosure. They should have been getting it forever, for that matter. You know, they're 70 years old and their income hasn't changed in years, but they didn't know about it. So the first time they hear about it is when they're in foreclosure and about to lose their house.
Some homeowners are getting hit with both barrels. They're eligible for poverty exemption but not getting it, and they're charged taxes at an unreal rate. Walter Hicks says the assessment of his house on the west side is ridiculous.
Because what they had the house worth this, I think $30,000 to $40,000. And when I got the house appraised, it was appraised for $9,000.
On top of that, Hicks has been eligible for the poverty exemption, but he was denied the exemption a couple of years ago. The city said he owned another house, and so he wasn't eligible for the exemption. It turns out it's someone else with the same first and last name. The clerk at the city hall told him nothing can be done about that. It's too late. Hicks explained his situation to the city. His story has been reported in the news media. Still, nothing.
Not a thing. You know, to rectify the problem, I know they done heard me. You know, I know they know the issue. You know, all I want them to do is correct the error that they made.
Now, Walter Hicks is a plaintiff in a lawsuit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union and the NAACP. Michael Steinberg is with the ACLU.
The bottom line is people are losing their homes for inability to pay taxes that they should never have had to pay in the first place.
The ACLU's Steinberg also says the city is breaking state law for failing to assess home values properly.
It's tragic. You know, the fact that the city is starting to come in line with state law helps people going forward, but it really doesn't help people who, and there's tens of thousands of them who have lost their homes over the past 5 years.
In emails responding to our questions, the Detroit mayor's office showed some progress on reassessments of property. They noted a dramatic drop in foreclosures this year, about half of what they were last year, and many people were put on payment plans. The city calls the ACLU lawsuit, quote, recklessly irresponsible, and says it would threaten basic city services to all Detroiters. The city's future is threatened regardless. Here's why. Without stable home ownership in a city, nothing is stable. Peter Hammer is a professor of law at Wayne State University.
One of the most important ways in which people acquire wealth, have that wealth increase, and transfer that wealth from one generation to the other is the house.
That happened for the white middle class. New Deal programs during the Great Depression helped white people get ahead, buy homes. It did not help black people. Many African Americans who did buy a home bought it in inner cities, where values have plummeted. Instead of increasing wealth, many black families lost wealth.
You look at the household, and then you look at the city, which is really the aggregation of all the households. And the same things that are preventing the individual household from aggregating wealth and being prosperous is also undermining the ability of the whole entire city to be aggregating wealth and being prosperous.
In an effort to keep the city of Detroit afloat, it's already taxing at a higher rate than anywhere else in the state. Its residents are among the poorest in the state. If the city is ever to see prosperity, it has to find a tax rate that its citizens can afford, or it will continue to force thousands of its residents out of their homes each year. And if history shows us anything, many of those homes will simply be abandoned, deteriorate, and eventually have to be demolished at city expense. Coming up, the people of Detroit are pushing back. We'll look at the rise in organizations who are taking protests to the streets. This is Separate and Unequal from Michigan Radio and the Detroit Journalism Cooperative. You're listening to Separate and Unequal. I'm Lester Graham. America still struggles with race in many of the ways it did after the uprisings and riots in 1967. But those struggles are changing. Since the Kerner Commission submitted its report back in 1968, the white majority has shrunk. As a result of that, and the recent white supremacist resurgence in the wake of Donald Trump's campaign and election, tensions have been rising. You can see it in anti-immigrant movements, in the feeling among some white people that they're being oppressed. Meanwhile, a new generation of black protest organizations has been taking to the streets as black Americans feel a greater threat from white-dominated politics and police. When many cities in the U.S. erupted in protests, riots, and uprisings in the 1960s, most white people were bewildered. Even today, some scholars argue that Americans, white Americans, have not learned the lesson of the 1960s uprisings or the recommendations to correct the problems.
In the wake of the Kerner Report, we have created two societies that are deeply unequal. That is a fact.
Heather Ann Thompson is a professor at the University of Michigan and wrote the book, Who's Detroit?
The inequality, income inequality, racial inequality, suburban city inequality, job inequality, we could just go on and on and on, is far worse. So we've done that. The question remains, what do we do next?
Resentment surrounding issues of race has been building over those decades. Resentment among blacks who still find themselves near the bottom of the economic ladder, and resentment among those whites who've been knocked down a rung or two. Paul Lee is a Detroit historian who's written about the 1967 uprising in Detroit. He says things are not any better today than they were in the 60s, and perhaps worse.
Our situation, that is the situation of African Americans in Detroit and throughout the country, I think is much more precarious than it's been perhaps in a century.
He bases that on the loss of the economic underpinnings of black neighborhoods. The relatively few middle-class black families who could afford it later followed white families to the suburbs. With them went some black businesses. The little economic power African Americans had in the city slipped away. But there was optimism because political power grew. In Detroit, when the black vote grew in strength, Detroit elected its first black mayor, Coleman Young. Young worked to make sure black residents were better represented in city departments.
Paul Lee says that does not mean the majority black population actually ran the city.
While I think that black political power is important, I think that if there's no economic foundation, then black power is relatively meaningless. Black political power is relatively meaningless.
In Detroit, with recent investments by billionaires, white billionaires, in the city's central business districts, there is a widely celebrated downtown revitalization. But many longtime residents in the neighborhoods don't feel they're included. They don't feel they're sharing in the new prosperity. Under the same kind of circumstances in the 1960s and 70s, we saw a rise in protest organizations, some of them militant. Former Detroit City Council member Sheila Cockrell was an activist alongside her late husband, Kenneth Cockrell. She is white. He was black. He was with the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. She says the term black power suddenly entered the national lexicon back then.
For many people, it was an expression of the necessity of being at the table, if you will, that when decisions are made, that the voices of black people are part of the decision-making.
In Detroit, dating back to at least the takeover by an emergency manager and then bankruptcy, new groups have been raising their voices in and around the city. Groups such as New Era Detroit, the Change Agent Consortium, the Detroit Water Brigade. There are protests for economic inclusion, against foreclosures and water shutoffs, and against police brutality.
No racist police! No racist police!
I'm hoping that in that constellation of organizations and people that there's going to emerge the next generation of authentic grassroots leadership that has a set of ideas that motivate people to act.
Some of those ideas are based on the belief that government ignores the needs of people of color.
We're skeptical of government because government isn't serving us.
Reverend Charles Williams II is the president of the Michigan chapter of National Action Network. He says people are frustrated that in many ways life in Detroit is worse now than it was in 1967.
As we see our struggle today, we see that some of those same issues are ahead of us. And so this is the reason why we must continue to organize, and it's the reason why we continue to organize.
And Williams believes black voices are getting louder because white voices are getting louder. He says since Barack Obama took office, certain white groups have escalated the rhetoric of bigotry and given it a national stage. He thinks that has a lot to do with a black man in the White House.
I think it had more to do not with his character, not with his willingness to go and meet and do and work, but the fact is he's African American.
And a black president is seen by some as the ultimate threat to white power structure and privilege. White resentment has led to a backlash, electing a man as president who has expressed racist opinions. Heather Ann Thompson, the University of Michigan professor, says policymakers today largely are ignoring the issues in the same way policymakers ignored them in the 1960s.
The good news is that we now, I think, are really hearing from those people who have suffered this very directly. And that's why Ferguson has blown up. And that's why Baltimore has exploded. And that's why people across cities in America or cities across America are speaking out and saying, no, we need a different civil rights movement, right? We need a different moment of change.
And to be effective, that change will have to negotiate opportunities for African Americans to be included in both political and economic power. That's part of the goal of Black Lives Matter. It is the most well-known national movement. It's also a target being blamed or at least associated with shootings of police officers in Denver and Baton Rouge. John Sloan III is a member of the core leadership team of the Detroit chapter of Black Lives Matter. He says the group started with protests because of the killings of unarmed African Americans, but it's not about one issue and it's not about violence toward police.
I want to be sure to make it clear that we are not an organization focused on one singular issue, right? We're not working just against the issue of police brutality. We're working to make sure that all black lives matter. In order to ensure that, we have to recognize from kind of a macro wide angle lens how all these areas in our community, in our lives, in our society are interconnected.
We've not seen the kind of events that led to Ferguson or Baltimore in Detroit. It's been suggested that since Detroit has a black and popular chief of police, James Craig, and the majority of the force is made up of African-American officers, that things won't explode in Detroit as they have in other cities. Do you think that's true?
Detroit is the blackest city in the nation, and this is not just me saying right. that as a qualifier.
Of the large cities,
Cities, right. And so, yes, I think those factors exist, and they could work to mitigate that type of Ferguson and Baltimore type of violence. But that's not to diminish the violence that exists on a daily basis. I want to be very clear. We're not walking around trying to accuse individual police officers. What we're talking about is the system at large. And so while you have individuals that might work in that system, do the best they can, that might be good, solid, upstanding individuals, and that are our neighbors and our brothers and our sisters, and you go to school with their kids and you play with them and you have cookouts with them on the 4th of July and on holidays, what we're talking about is a system that is inherently antithetical to racial equity, that inherently works against black and brown bodies and criminalizes them and creates violence and perpetrates violence against them on a systemic level. And as long as that system is in place, you're going to have this inequity inherent to our culture and society. This is not something that just came up, right, that just started happening 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. The difference now is that everybody has a camera.
Right.
Everybody's a citizen journalist.
In fact, there was a big study out of Harvard that said we're not seeing any more black people shot by police than we ever did before.
Absolutely.
We're just seeing it on social media.
Absolutely. I do think, though, there's a risk and a concern about backlash. And what we want to be careful about, because we are completely a nonviolent movement, but what we want to be careful about is making sure that we are aware that if police officers are feeling a certain pressure, right, that there is a potential, because everybody's human, for retaliation. Is there evidence that that has happened? No. But I think that we have, as an organization, as a culture, as a society, have to be careful about how we have the conversation. There's a lot of talk whenever something happens about we have to have this national conversation, and there will be a panel, and there will be a police officer and a reverend, and everybody will pat themselves on the back, and that'll be the end of it. But how you have the conversation, how you follow through with the conversation, is why an organization like ours still exists.
I want to ask you about the group at the national level. There's been an effort to tie Black Lives Matter to the shooting of police in Dallas and Baton Rouge. One of the shooters made some kind of statement about Black Lives Matter. It doesn't appear that there was any real affiliation with the group. But it does bring you to the question, are all of your members committed to nonviolence?
I can't speak for every single person in the country that has joined a chapter. But what I will say is that organizationally, we are absolutely a nonviolent group. We all agree to abide by certain guiding principles. And one of the key tenets is uplifting individuals, is understanding the intersectionality that we all live in as a society and as culture. And violence in and of itself is antithetical at its core. Unlike in the 60s of the civil rights movement, social media has allowed for a new type of activism. And so Black Lives Matter got started as a hashtag that grew into a larger organization. And so there is a tendency sometimes for individuals who might be misguided to want to latch on to that. And I'm only saying misguided in the sense that using violence to try to achieve these ends. That was a tragedy on all fronts, and there's not a single member of our organization that supports that type of violence.
John Sloan III is with the Detroit chapter of Black Lives Matter. In looking at race in America, the Detroit Journalism Cooperative conducted a poll this year. Attitudes about race have been improving in Southeast Michigan, but there are still wide gaps on some issues between white people and black people. The survey included people from mostly black communities, mixed race communities, and mostly white communities in the Detroit metropolitan area. Its results should not be interpreted as a view of the population at large. This was intentionally designed as a microcosm of black, white, and mixed-race communities. When asked to rank the importance of race relations, black and white people ranked it below issues such as education and crime. Bernie Porn is with the polling firm Epic MRA. He says the historic divide between white people and black people in the Detroit metro is changing. Older white and black residents tend to be farther apart on many issues, while younger people are closer.
Clearly, there has been an evolution of opinion and changing demographics.
He thinks part of the reason is more socialization between the races, especially in suburbs close to the city. However, black people and white people are far apart on a handful of important issues. One of the respondents, an African-American man who only gave his name as Lamar, says being black today still means discrimination.
When I go to my interest rates in terms of my borrowing, my mortgages, et cetera, all of those things. Also, I can't go shop in a mall without being profiled and followed as if I'm a thief.
He added, in Michigan, it's chiefly the black communities which are being taken over by state-appointed emergency managers. The survey revealed more than half the people of color say they're treated as suspect in a retail store or treated as if they're not smart. But a researcher says those are things that only society can change. You can't pass a law or make public policy requiring white people to treat black people with respect. Joe T. Darden is a professor at Michigan State University. He says the most important findings in the survey are white attitudes toward black responses about their treatment in housing, loans, education, and voting.
Do whites believe that blacks are treated differently? And do blacks believe that blacks are treated differently?
And in many cases, this survey shows there are major differences. Despite research showing African Americans and Latino Americans are discriminated against by real estate agents, bankers, in employment opportunities, in the courts, and by police, many white people don't believe it.
Whites say things or think things that are just not consistent with the research. When they believe that blacks, for example, are treated the same when it comes to mortgage lending, if they believe that, it's just not true. And so, in a sense, that has to be corrected.
Darden says lawmakers and policymakers need to be better informed about these issues and make adjustments to ensure equal treatment of people of color.
Those are key because if blacks feel that they're not treated the same as whites, grievances emerge that may be potentially dangerous down the line.
Darden says that's exactly what happened in Detroit in 1967. While there is greater agreement between whites and blacks, even today there are still some huge gaps in how whites understand the experience of being black. Since the shooting of Trayvon Martin in Florida in 2012, more white people have paid closer attention to the shootings and killings of African Americans, especially when police were involved. Part of the reason for greater awareness and concern is cell phone video and the internet. Technology has just made more people of all races aware. Some white people have been surprised.
For people of color, we always knew that happened. Like, I've been stopped by the police for no reason. My mom referred to it as driving while black, DWB. The media attention to those stories just brought it out to everyone that wasn't a person of color.
That's Lauren Hood. She conducts diversity training for corporations and works to encourage dialogue about race in Detroit. She says for many white people, race is a very difficult thing to discuss. That's even true if you think of yourself as enlightened or progressive or liberal.
It's a place that most people aren't willing to go, and particularly people that are liberal and think they're doing the right thing all the time. So if you think you've already arrived at some point of consciousness and someone tells you you're not quite there yet, you're not ready for it, you get defensive.
And if improving race relations is a goal, getting defensive instead of talking is a problem.
Especially right now with so much like national news and conversation happening around these topics too, you'd think that more people would be plugged in. But personally, my experience is that some of my closest friends who I think are progressive don't necessarily spend a lot of time thinking about these issues.
That's Claire Nelson. She runs an organization called Urban Consulate. That organization brings together economic developers and investors with people who want to start new small businesses. Recently, it's been inviting the people who live in mostly black neighborhoods. The idea is to sit down and talk.
Oftentimes when you're talking about development investment, the people speaking about that are the people who are representing, you know, the banks or commercial interests.
I'm guessing that's a lot of white faces.
Yes. And so we're trying to flip that a little bit and have the voices leading conversations be people who are more community-based, who are or creative artists or who've been around a little longer, can share some history and context.
Nelson, who is white, says including more diverse voices, people of color, people who actually live in Detroit, hearing those concerns in the conversations about economic development has been an eye-opener for some people, including her. She says in the past, she saw segregation as a matter of the white suburbs versus the black city. Now she says she can see segregation up close at the neighborhood level because of those talks. Just as the Kerner Commission reported in 1968, today racism is about white attitudes toward people of color. Sometimes that's because of bigotry. Sometimes it's unconscious bias. Lauren Hood says the only way to begin to fix that is to talk to people who are subjected to that bias.
In order to move forward, we just have to be fearless in having these conversations.
Fearless conversations. African Americans say racism is a white problem. They're the majority. They hold most of the political power. They hold most of the economic power. White people for generations designed the system that puts people of color at a disadvantage in America. It's up to white people to start talking about the country and ask why our people are separate and unequal. Production assistance for Separate and Unequal came from the Oral History Project at the LBJ Library, Michigan Archives with the Michigan Center for History, and from St. Louis Public Radio. Assistance in reporting came from Bill McGraw and Mike Wilkinson with Bridge Magazine, Sandra Svoboda with WDET, and Sarah Swick with Michigan Radio. This documentary was edited by Sarah Hewlett and Vincent Duffy. The Detroit Journalism Cooperative is a collaboration by Detroit Public TV, Bridge Magazine, WDET, New Michigan Media, and Michigan Radio. Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative on Michigan Radio comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, Renaissance Journalism, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Lester Graham.